The backstory to a daring rescue in Iraq, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the middle of a firefight with ISIS militants in Mosul, an American relief worker risks his life to save one little girl.
Then I thought, well, if I die saving this little girl, my wife and children will understand. And I just went for it.
But David Eubanks says he's just one of many risking it all in Mosul.
Every day I saw Iraqi soldiers, who mostly are Shia, risking their lives for Sunnis. And it made me think, wow, this is a hope for the future of Iraq.
Plus, how a new heir to the throne in Saudi Arabia could shake things up in the Middle East.
He is atypical in terms of Saudi foreign policy in that he seems to be much more aggressive and much more willing to take the initiative.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being here. We've got a lot to get to this Wednesday, including those congressional hearings today on Russian hacking into the U.S. election. We want to start the show, though, with the story of a man who was admirable, heroic even. But his story does really make you think about what it means to be a role model. How far do you take it? Let me explain. David Eubank is a 10-year veteran of the U.S. Army Special Forces. These days, he's an aid worker with a relief group he founded called the Free Burma Rangers, started when he was a humanitarian worker in Burma, also known as Myanmar. Eubank has been in a lot of risky areas and war zones. Most recently, his work has taken him, along with his wife, Karen, and their three children, to the besieged city of Mosul in Iraq. Iraqi forces are battling to force ISIS out of the western part of the city, and it's a house-by-house fight. Earlier this month, Eubank says he got a call from an Iraqi army unit asking him to help some wounded civilians.
So we went and got up to a place where the Iraqi military, they were in a gunfight with ISIS across a big highway, and that road was littered with bodies, and then the sunset, and there's fighting all night, and people were crawling across that road at night, and we were trying to help them and treat them. The next morning, we went down to the road. You had to kind of creep around because anytime you showed any part of your body, ISIS would shoot. They had a long, clear shot down this double divided highway. They'd blown up Iraqi tanks, bulldozers, Humvees, killed anybody who tried to go across it, and had been shooting civilians as they tried to flee to us. And then amongst all the dead people, and there was guys in wheelchairs shot dead. There was old women and old men. There was young mothers. I saw this beautiful lady on her back, dead with a baby next to her, shot dead, a bullet hole right in the head. Then I looked past them about 150 yards up against a wall. I could see movement. And as I looked, I said, hey, there's a little kid there. She's hiding under her dead mom's hijab. She keeps coming out underneath it. And then one man saw us and made a motion with his arm very weakly. He'd obviously been shot. He's laying back up against the wall.
How do you calculate what to do in a situation like that?
Yeah, it's instant death if you cross the road. I mean, there were armored vehicles didn't make it. And I just said this prayer. And I called the Americans who are old friends. You know, I was in the military before the Rangers and Special Forces, and I have friends who are still in. And I described the situation to them. Of course, they're monitoring it on drone feeds. So the Americans coordinated with the Iraqi forces that we were with for smoke. And I talked to the Iraqis and said, can you give us a tank and a bulldozer, and we'll move our Humvees, and we'll push up in there and rescue whoever we can. They said, a tank, yes, no bulldozer, no Humvees, they'll get blown up. Can't afford it. So the Americans laid down an amazing barrage of smoke. The Iraqis agreed to send a tank. We ran behind the tank, which is kind of like going over a roller coaster, except when it comes off the rails. It was just right. Like bullets everywhere. And we're just running behind it.
Let's listen to the video from that moment. So in this video, and you can see it at our website, people, PRI.org, your colleagues are shooting at ISIS to give you cover, and you rush out from behind this tank, scoop up this tiny girl, she's got pigtails, and you make it back. I mean, what was going through your mind as you run out into that fire to rescue this girl?
What went through my mind was, I'm going to die. And I'm not fatalistic. Normally, I don't think I'm going to die at all. I mean, there's always a way, you know, whether you're mountain climbing or skydiving or combat. But this was so bad, I thought, I'm going to die. Then I thought, well, if I die saving this little girl, my wife and children will understand. And I just went for it and got to her, and they were shooting at us, but didn't hit me. Then I grabbed the girl and we ran back, and I was just like, oh, God, thank you. It was terrifying for me.
Were you able to rescue anybody else?
I put the girl in one of my guy's hands, and I ran back for another guy and got my two of my volunteers, a guy named Sky, a guy named Ephraim. to help me, and we got two men back. But as we moved, the tank's backing up faster and faster because it's getting hit constantly by ISIS rounds. And in the middle of that, one of my guys, a guy named Ephraim, was shot through the calf. One of the people that we were help carrying fell off the litter and into the street, and ISIS probably shot him right then. But anyways, we couldn't recover him. So we only rescued that little girl, which I was holding on to, and one man. That's all we were able to do. Everybody else was dead.
This group of Iraqi civilians that you saw shot in front of the Pepsi factory and those images of the walking dead, it's not that unusual. This is the everyday reality civilians in Mosul are living right now.
Yes, very much so. The next day we went without the tank, without support. We found there's five more people, a girl on a cell phone. She'd been shot for 3 days, no water, broken the hip. She had a phone that still works. She said, I'm alive in here. So we had the second day to go back inside the Pepsi factory, which ISIS controlled, creeping inside it to get five more people out. One lady, she was out in the street and where ISIS could see her, but behind a car. 3 days, no water, shot through the hip also, different lady. And then the next day, more people shot.
I don't know many Americans like you, David, but I wonder how many Iraqis are kind of doing the same sort of incredibly dangerous work that you're doing.
Without the Iraqi soldiers, there's no way we could do this. The guys in the tank, that meant pretty sure death. They were in front of us because they had anti-tank systems, the ISIS did, ZSU-23 anti-aircraft guns in ground mode. They'd already blown up almost every piece of armor that tried to cross that road. And that tank, that five-man tank crew, four-man tank crew, just took it on. And the next day when we went to save the five people in the rubble, I led the first mission. I did not lead the second mission. The second mission was led by an Iraqi private who said, we have no plan to do this, but I'm going to do it. Who will go with me? Every day I saw Iraqi soldiers who mostly are Shia risking their lives for Sunnis. And it made me think, wow, this is the hope for the future of Iraq. The Iraqi army is overall doing a fantastic job of saving lives and fighting ISIS, and they need more help.
Well, that's encouraging to hear about the Sunnis and Shia working together. How does the U.S. military feel about you? Do they see you as an asset?
One guy said I was a 2-meter drone, you know, just a low level. Yeah, well, we're friends. You know, we have no official capacity. I can't tell them to do anything, but I can ask them to look at something, and then they take their own actions.
You're living a mile from the front line. Your wife is there, Karen, and three children, ages 16, 14, and 11. I'd like us to hear some sound from a video. You're driving with two volunteers. One is your daughter, through what can only be described as a hellscape in war-ravaged Mosul. Here you are.
It's driving through Mosul with Sahaley. What do you think, honey?
I'm very happy I get to be here. Blessed I get this opportunity to help people. And praise God that no one got hurt today.
All right, so your daughter's very happy to help and really impressed by what you're doing. I'm assuming you thought long and hard about taking your kids to a war zone.
Yes, before we had children, we were involved in Burma 25 years ago. And when Karen got pregnant and we were talking about raising kids, we both said, are we going to keep taking them into Burma? Because if they die, how can we live? How can we live with each other or ourselves? And that we already knew what that would feel like. But as we prayed about it, we felt that don't be led by dangers and comforts and possibilities of evil. Be led by opportunities. And we thought there's no better way we can raise our kids. And so we've raised our kids amongst other kids. And we have kind of a general idea that if a family or kids are there, my kids can be there. If there's nobody but men fighting, then they probably don't need to be there. But if there's a family in need, we will try to be there if we can help. And so my kids have all experienced, you know, gunfire, mortars, machine guns, usually not at the front line, but always if there's other families, they try to help. So I don't want my kids to die at all. We try to protect them, but we don't want to protect them from other people's needs. We don't want to insulate them from the real situation of the world. And we don't want to inhibit what we feel God can do in their lives to help other people.
I mean, that's really noble. I can't tell, though, if you're an amazing parent modeling your values for your kids to the hilt by making them see what the world is, or if you're being totally irresponsible. Do you ever second guess your decision?
Yes. Usually when things go really bad. And, you know, one of the worst is my kids all got malaria and one got malaria and got typhus and almost died in the jungle of Burma back when you couldn't just walk out. The Burma army's in our way. And we always made a decision. We'll only do for our kids what we do for other kids. So if I'd move heaven and earth to move in an ethnic kid to safety, I do the same for my family. But I won't just because my family's in trouble, say, okay, all you ethnic guys got to die for us to get me out of here. We won't do that. You know, I try to keep them out of direct gunfire. We try to keep them, try to be responsible, because those are I love my kids more than anything else in the world. Like I think almost any parent, we do our best to keep them that way, but they always have a choice and they've chosen to go with us. And so for us, we've been in war zones since the kids were born. They're not all the same. If families are there, most families have found a way to survive reasonably, or they move. And so usually, yes, there's fighting on this block of the city, but if you go to that block, you're going to be okay. And that's where families normally go. And so we try to go with those families and give comfort, give help. But that's obviously everyone has to make their own decisions. But it's worked that way. And the kids have enabled us to do things that we couldn't do alone. They've opened doors. I was in Afghanistan accidentally among the Taliban. And what saved us was my kids. And they realized, you're not here to kill us. You brought your kids. You're just like us. And I was in Sudan in the Nuba Mountains. And the leader of the Nuba people said, you know what? We know you want nothing from us because you brought your kids, which means you think we're just as valuable as you are.
Speaking of kids, take us back to the little girl you rescued in Mosul. Her entire family is gone. Did you ever learn her name?
I did not learn her name because she would not say it. When I left, which is about 4 days ago, she still was not talking. She'd make little mumbles, but she would not talk. And so, I'm assuming the trauma of being under her dead mom's hijab for 2 days with the rest of her family slaughtered and 70 more people at least around her dead. I think that's, she hasn't talked. Now, she did when the General Mustafa, who was a unit we're working with, started helping take care of her. She warmed up to him. He's speaking Arabic. He's like a grandfather to her. And he's so sweet. He was crying over her. She warmed up, but she still didn't give her name. Then maybe she has by now since we left.
What do you think?
We put her face out on Facebook.
Yeah.
In Iraq, everybody does Facebook trying to find a living relative. And so far, none. So our plan is that, but it looks like the general's going to adopt her if the family doesn't appear.
How do civilians feel about ISIS?
They hate him and they're so afraid of him. We talked to a little kid who said, I can't go with you because ISIS said that even if they die, their spirits will come back and they'll slaughter us if we go with anybody else. And the kid believed it, that the spirits of ISIS would come back and kill them. So they're terrified of them. They've lived in horror. Earlier, a couple months ago, when we were in the further west side of Mosul, people were evacuating and we were in an area that we were not getting shot at. So I'd load them up in my Land Cruisers and we'd be driving them back. And I turned on music that I got actually in Syria, a love song, really cool sounding love song. I turned it on thinking this would be neat. All the men started crying and then the women started crying. They hadn't heard a love song for 3 years. Can I play it for you real quick?
I'd love that. Yeah.
Can you hear that?
Loud and clear. Yeah. I'm imagining the car filled with all these people and everybody's just sobbing, listening to this.
They wanted to hear it. Sometimes you got to cry. And they just cried and cried and cried.
David, thank you very much for speaking with us. I know some of our listeners may wonder about your qualities as a father, but you're doing some pretty terrific work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And your listeners, just ask my kids, and that's the test. But it's up for the judgment if I'm a complete idiot or not. And if someone said I was an idiot, I wouldn't argue that. I would just say, I love my kids. I'm doing my best. But thanks for caring, not just about my kids and American kids, but about Iraqi kids.
That was David Eubank. He and his family are now back in the States, but they're thinking about going back to Mosul maybe in a month or two. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've been talking this week about hate crimes. Yesterday, we heard a story about a community in St. Louis looking for answers to why their Jewish cemetery was vandalized. Today, a murder in Tulsa, Oklahoma, last August. It's being prosecuted as a hate crime, but it's not clear to the family that the designation makes much of a difference. The World's Daniel Gross tells that story.
Haifa Jabara moved her family to Tulsa to escape a civil war. The Jabara family is Christian, and during the 1980s, their home country of Lebanon was a dangerous place.
We were always scared. The kids go to school. We don't know if they're going to come back or not.
Haifa's daughter Vicky says that after the move, she and her brothers had typical American childhoods. They understood Arabic, but spoke English.
When you move to Tulsa in the 80s as a foreigner, you know, your goal is to assimilate.
Vicky says her light skin helped her fit in. But her brother Khalid had darker skin and a foreign-sounding name. Khalid was a computer whiz. He loved wordplay in Arabic and English, and he loved basketball.
He kind of was a hustler. You know, he would be like, oh yeah, you want me to play on your team? Okay. And then he would beat them all with his skills, and he just thought that was really funny.
After the siblings grew up and moved out, Khalid came back to care for a sick father. Sometimes he'd visit the next-door neighbor, an elderly man who liked computers too. Then, a few years ago, a man named Stanley Majors moved in with the neighbor. After living together as a couple, the two men got married, and life for the Jabaras started to change.
It feels hurtful that we escaped, you know, a country of violence, a civil war, to seek safety. And then, you know, 30 years later, it ended in violence.
Haifa says the new neighbor, Majors, yelled racial slurs. She says Majors even started calling her.
You would just call your house?
Yes, call me on my cell phone. How did he know on my cell phone? I don't know. Say dirty words. He come take pictures of everybody that come to my house.
Haifa took out a protective order against Majors, but the harassment escalated. In 2015, Majors ran Haifa down with his car, and she was rushed to the hospital with a head injury and broken bones. Local police arrested Majors and charged him with a hit and run. According to the Jabaras, the district attorney said he was not eligible for bail. But then, after 8 months, Majors got out on bond. When Haifa found out, she was so terrified, she started looking for a new house. Her husband uses a wheelchair, so the search took time. A couple months later, Haifa was out running errands when Khalid called from home. It was August 12th, 2016.
He said, "Don't come home." I said, "Why?" He said, "But I just learned that this crazy guy has a gun." He felt really upset and scared. I said, "What? So what? If he has a gun, you mean he's going to kill you or something, kill me?"
When Khalid called the police, they came. But they told him that they could not enter the neighbor's house without a warrant. So they left. Khalid and his mom spoke on the phone one more time.
I heard everything. I was on the phone. All the time I was with my son. And my son was screaming and yelling, "Help, help." And I was not there to help him. I went crazy.
8 minutes after the police left, prosecutors say Stanley Majors shot Khalid Jabara 3 times on the porch. He lay on the floor bleeding while his father called 911. Doctors pronounced him dead at the hospital. Officer Jeannie McKenzie is a spokesperson for the Tulsa County Police. Even though Majors had committed a violent offense and had a history of harassing the Jabara family, McKenzie said repeatedly that there was nothing the police could do.
You know, we as police officers, we're bound by the law. There are certain things that we can and can't do. And in this situation, there was nothing we could do to prevent this incident occurring. Officers went out for the original call. They spoke with all parties or one party involved, but the other party refused to voluntarily speak with officers. And at that point, without a crime being committed, there was nothing we could do.
Vicky and her mom, Haifa, believed the police failed when they left without confronting Stanley Majors.
If it was an Arab or a black man that had a gun, I bet you anything.
They will go in.
They'll go in.
They've lost faith in the law.
America is great. We love America. But the justice system failed us. That's all.
Stanley Majors goes on trial in August. In addition to first-degree murder, he has been charged with a hate crime. That means prosecutors will try to prove that Majors harbors bias and that bias motivated the murder. In interviews with the police, Majors said the Jabaras were filthy Lebanese who, quote, throw gay people off the roof. He seemed to be referring to a graphic video released by ISIS. Tulsa's district attorney's office didn't want to comment on the details of the case. Neither did Rob Nye, the Tulsa County public defender, who will represent Majors. But I did ask Nye whether hate crime laws actually prevent hate crimes. He said no. Hate crimes are misdemeanors in Oklahoma. They don't lead to serious sentences on their own. Do you see any patterns in terms of acts of discrimination, acts of hate over the years? Have they gone up? Have they gone down?
It seems as though they've gone up. We are more divisive than we used to be. We're less tolerant than we used to be. And that's tremendously unfortunate.
Nye thinks hate crimes should be felonies, but he also believes that victims and the media should be cautious not to jump to conclusions. During our interview, Haifa Jabara called her son's murder a hate crime, but she wasn't sure why that distinction is so important.
What's the difference, hate crime and a crime?
It's true that a hate crime conviction would not have a big impact on the sentence. It's the murder conviction that really counts. But hate crimes can have an impact on the national level because they're visible. Activists count them. Hate crimes are easier to rally around than crimes that are seen as isolated events. I asked the Jabaras what they hope will happen in the coming months.
Just to have a fair trial, fair justice. We want justice. That's all.
Like what? Justice? Like he's in jail forever or death penalty?
Of course. I mean, we would like to have death penalty, but it's maybe to stay in jail forever is better for him to suffer.
So also so he can't hurt others.
Vicky Jabara says her young daughter is starting to understand what happened to her uncle Khalid.
But I haven't talked to her about how violent he died.
So violently. How did it must have hurt? And it must have... What was he thinking? I mean, he was probably thinking, what did I do?
Vicky's daughter attends a Jewish day school in Tulsa. The school plans to open a library of tolerance in Khalid Jabara's name. Vicky says she takes heart from one of the school's daily mantras. Peace begins with me. For The World, Daniel Gross, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
We're partnering with ProPublica on a project called Documenting Hate. If you've experienced or witnessed what you think is a hate crime, you can share that story with us at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a family refuses to be broken up. The dad is deported to El Salvador. Mom and kids, all U.S. citizens, struggle without him. So they end up moving there, too, to a town run by drug gangs.
They say this is one of the worst neighborhoods in this town, but we feel safe here because they've taken us in. They've accepted us.
That story, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Russia's meddling in the 2016 election was a focus of two hearings today on Capitol Hill, though the hearing in the House Intelligence Committee seemed to be less about Russia and more about Washington politics. The main event in that hearing was testimony from Barack Obama's former Homeland Security Chief, Jay Johnson. The Washington Post's Peter Stevenson covered the hearing.
We heard Jay Johnson talk about how he really didn't have Russian interference on his radar until he learned about this hack of the DNC last summer. The Democratic National Committee learned over the course of the summer that it was the target of Russian hackers. Government officials went to them and said, look, we believe you are being hacked. And the DNC essentially said to the Department of Homeland Security, we don't need you guys. We already have our own outsourced software. They work with a group called CrowdStrike, and they believed that that was enough to keep them safe. The secretary said very bluntly, I was frustrated that they didn't accept my help. And it was kind of confusing because it wasn't like it was coming from a Republican administration. This was political allies of the DNC coming to them and saying, you are being hacked and we can help you. And they refused that help. And it's kind of baffling.
Now, there was some frustration on the committee today, even among Democrats, about how long it took the Obama administration to respond to the hacking. Let's listen to this exchange between Jay Johnson and ranking Democrat Adam Schiff.
Why did it take the administration so long to make a public statement that a foreign adversary was trying to influence the American election? The statement didn't come until October. Why did we wait from July till October to make that statement?
Well, Congressman, I'm going to disagree with your premise that there was some type of delay. This was a big decision, and there were a lot of considerations that went into it. First, as you know well, we have to carefully consider whether declassifying the information compromises sources and methods. Second, there was an ongoing election, and many would criticize us for perhaps taking sides in the election. So that had to be carefully considered.
It is hard to imagine Obama's former head of Homeland Security would seriously criticize himself or his boss. Do we know enough about what was happening or not happening on Obama's watch?
That information is just starting to come out, and frankly, a lot of it is being kept under wraps because of the ongoing special counsel investigation. There are a lot of questions that journalists and lawmakers have about what the Russian government did, what state-associated hackers did, and when.
Right. That was going to be my next question. When did it all come into focus for the Obama White House?
Well, what we heard from Jay Johnson today is that it started to become an issue in the front of his mind over the summer and stayed there through the entire fall. But like he said in his testimony, he was very reluctant to comment on it publicly. It's a bad look for elected officials to come out in the weeks before an election and talk about an ongoing investigation. And that's one of the reasons we haven't heard a whole lot about it.
I mean, given that a lot of people are seeing the Democrats as the actors who will aggressively push forward with this investigation, not Republicans, I mean, it sounds like Johnson's testimony might not be very helpful.
That's exactly right. It might not be very helpful for Democrats in two ways. Just the visuals of Democrats being told Russia is coming after you and they didn't do a whole lot about it. Well, all of a sudden, since Donald Trump won the election, they seem a lot more energized and a lot more willing to pursue the investigation farther. So it doesn't look great from an optics perspective.
Something that I thought was surprising was that Johnson said the DNC did not want Homeland Security's help at first. And he also said that state election officials are also wary of federal interference. I mean, it seems like maybe part of the problem is not just lack of trust in Russia, but also here, no one in the government trusts each other.
That's exactly right. And when you look at the way that our state election systems are set up, even for national elections, they're done very differently state by state. Each state has its own registration system. Each state has its own vote tally system. When you talk about the voting machines, people are asking questions about whether voter machines were hacked and vote tallies were hacked. Well, each state has its own system for keeping track of all of that stuff. So when you have a federal official going to state election officials saying, hey, this is a concern, apparently a lot of them were concerned about a, quote, federal election takeover. They didn't want the feds, so to speak, to be interfering in their election processes, which they see as a very clearly defined state's right.
So lots of Washington politics in the House hearings. Did the Senate hearings, did they talk about Russia?
They did. The FBI's top counterterrorism official did testify that 21 states were the target of Russian hacks. Their election systems were targeted. They were looked over. It's unclear what information was taken from them, but we do know that no votes were changed, no actual voter rolls were accessed. But the other side of that question is, well, okay, if Russian hackers didn't go in and change actual vote tallies, does that mean they didn't affect the election at all? And the answer to that is we're not really sure. Jay Johnson said in the House hearing, you'd have to talk to a sociologist or a psychologist to see if these efforts at interference actually had an effect on anyone's vote.
Peter Stevenson with The Washington Post. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brazil is caught up in its own political turmoil. For weeks now, President Michel Temer has been facing growing allegations tying him to a massive bribery scheme. And yesterday, Brazil's federal police, their equivalent of the FBI, said there's solid evidence that Temer benefited from bribes. For more on this, we turn to reporter Catherine Osborne, who's based in Rio de Janeiro. What is this new evidence, Catherine?
So the federal police have analyzed material that's been coming out over the past month that are secretly made recordings and videos, and they say that's evidence that the president participated in passive corruption, which is basically taking bribes.
Who made those recordings?
Members of a meatpacking conglomerate who were trying to reduce their own sentence in this big anti-corruption probe. So because of new laws trying to strengthen anti-corruption investigations in Brazil, you can basically snitch on other people in exchange for a reduced sentence. And not only have they snitched, they have secretly recorded via tapes and video aides of the president and the president himself.
So are they opponents of Temer, or they just wanted a lenient sentence?
You know, they used to not be opponents, but now they've decided that it's in their best interest to produce evidence against him. He is somebody who has been in politics for a long time, knows everyone, and essentially was able to last this long in office because allies have been cooperating with him. And the meatpacking brothers, the Batista brothers, are people who in the past thought it was a good idea for them to protect him, and now they've changed their tune.
Yeah, well, it's hard to dispute tape recordings. Richard Nixon paid the price. Will these accusations stick? Will this just intensify calls for impeachment of Michelle Temer?
Sure. So that's the million-dollar question. And a lot of folks are actually making comparisons with the United States because there's so much solid evidence that the president participated in wrongdoing. But at the same time, most of Congress is still defending him. And so he needs to have two-thirds of congressmen vote in order for an investigation in the Supreme Court to be opened against him. Most analysts say that's unlikely still. So even though we have all this on tape, he said on tape, yes, keep paying hush money to this other ex-congressman, and an aide of his has been recorded accepting money in a suitcase. Predictions are right now that he'll stay in office. Individual congressmen can also present impeachment charges against him, and now over a dozen impeachment charges have been registered against him, but they still also are unlikely to take him down.
Catherine, there have been several political scandals in Brazil in the past few years, including one impeached president, Dilma Rousseff. How tired, how fatigued are Brazilians by all these scandals?
I think that the shock factor has worn off a little bit, in that folks suspected that this corruption was going on all along, and now it's really hard to amaze the public. What's really difficult is that the price is being paid the most by Brazilians who have lost their jobs and are seeing a poor economy in recent years. So there is sort of a fatigue of following along and going out into the street and protesting. At the same time, it feels like a moment for a lot of Brazilians when the rules are really getting rewritten about how much of this corruption is being exposed. And there's a sense that Temer has lost legitimacy. Whether he finishes his term or not, folks want a different kind of leadership next time around when they get to vote. And so it's a feeling of a lot of things being up in the air in Brazil. And even though there's horrible behavior by public leaders, the public is being aware of it and having a big conversation about what they want next.
That was reporter Catherine Osborne speaking with us from Rio de Janeiro. Deportation is on the minds of a lot of people, and every day it seems we hear the story of someone expelled from the U.S. Today we're looking at what happens when the breadwinner of the family is deported. What do the spouse and kids do, especially when they're U.S. citizens? Tipa Fernandez spent time with one American family, now living 2 hours from El Salvador's capital, in a small town run by gangs.
I'm in a car with Waldo Martinez and Andrea Hernandez in Sensantepeque. They're headed to pick up their two daughters from school.
Hey, Mom.
Andrea's mom has just called from Las Vegas. That's where the family used to live until Waldo was deported to El Salvador in 2014. 2 years later, unable to make it without him in Las Vegas, and missing him tremendously, the family moved here too.
I'm on my way to get the girls. I'm so sorry.
Her mom's in the middle of trying to get her granddaughter's school records from the Las Vegas school they used to attend.
Are you there?
Andrea's phone cuts out.
Do you have minutes?
No.
She's filling out paperwork and she doesn't know what to write. And I don't have Messenger now.
Okay, let me try.
The town, Sensantepeque, is charming. It has cobbled streets, a small central square, very old stone buildings.
Some of these buildings are 300 or 400 years old, and where I'm from, that there's nothing even 100 years old.
You born and raised in Las Vegas?
I was raised there. My dad was in the Air Force, so I was born in Texas. But we moved back. My parents grew up in Las Vegas, and we moved back when I was just a baby, so.
Andrea calls herself a white American. Her husband, Waldo, was born in El Salvador and raised in this very town. He came to the U.S. in the 90s, escaping the country's civil war. After 25 years in Las Vegas, and despite applying for asylum and temporary protected status, and despite his years-long marriage to a U.S. citizen, Waldo's immigration case was never resolved. When, in 2013, he landed in jail and pled guilty to one count of failing to report an injury to a foster child in his care, he was deported.
Life got incredibly hard for Andrea and their four kids.
We went from making $90,000 one year to being on welfare.
She couldn't make it without Waldo. So despite speaking no Spanish, nor having ever visited her husband's native country, Andrea Hernandez packed up her four kids and decided to move to El Salvador.
You know, it might look peaceful and stuff, you know what I mean? But it's just the way it is. And I mean, everybody knows, you know, like the people, like the gangsters and stuff.
Gangsters is what he said. Gangs have come by and swooped up kids right as they leave the school building. So coming early and waiting out front is what Andrea and Waldo do every day. Inside, both their daughters are busy.
Your hands! Oh no!
Watch this.
Andy is 9. Kids in her class try out their English on her as they play.
Good. He has 7.
Meanwhile, in a classroom just off the courtyard come playground, the eldest Hernandez daughter, 16-year-old Lelix, is immersed in a writing class.
Igual Michelle, ella creo que se acordaba de la historia, pero quizás habían pequeñas partes que no se acordaba y por eso lo leyó, ¿no?
Only she doesn't really speak much Spanish.
¿Qué piensa usted de la historia de Michelle?
She used to be a straight A's 9th grader in Las Vegas. Now she's just trying to keep up. But she's saved by the bell.
Hi, babe. You ready to walk?
And they set off, navigating thin streets with pulsing traffic and no sidewalks. Hernandez checks in about how the day went as they dart around cars and people. And they discuss the upcoming field day.
She has a soccer, yeah, she has a soccer uniform, but I figured
she... We have teams.
Oh boy.
I'm with my 2 friends.
Elder daughter Lelix power walks ahead. It's 90 degrees and intensely humid. Her mum tries to catch up to her.
It's already hard enough being the white kid in town.
Despite having a brown-skinned, Spanish-speaking father, back in Las Vegas, Lelix didn't feel ethnic.
I was the white girl in the neighborhood all the time, and they were like, all the girls would always tell me, even when I got here, they're like, you're blonde. And I'm like, this is not blonde.
The highlight of the homeward trek? Or maybe it's the necessary fuel to make the miles-long walk go quicker. Ice cream.
That choco banana one I had last time was good. Get 2 of those.
Y me da 2 de la de choco banana, me da 2. 6, total.
Ice creams in hand, the family continues on homeward. Andrea starts pointing out the houses of gang members.
They say this is one of the worst neighborhoods in this town.
That's where you live.
But we feel safe here because... they've taken us in. They've accepted us.
So how did that happen?
Because he grew up here, I guess, and we have family here, and they watched us for quite a while. They weren't immediately friendly to us. But I think just, like, acting nice to them and befriending them and just them watching us and seeing that we're normal people and...
I would say mind your business, you know. Yeah.
And so they've kind of... most people are nice to us and say hello and have accepted us, so we're like part. But now we belong to them. That's what the thing is. Someone gave us another house in another area, but it's a rival area, so we couldn't accept it. Because if we went there, we would be in trouble over there, and then we would never be allowed to come back here.
It's eerily quiet. A few guys are milling about. They stare as we walk by. It's tense. I'm struck by the question of why any mother would bring her children to live amidst this danger. We'll find out tomorrow. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, in Santepique, El Salvador.
And tomorrow we'll hear more about life for the family in this gang-controlled town. Deepa's reporting is supported by the IWMF as part of its Adelante Latin America reporting initiative. A major shift just happened in Saudi Arabia. The King Salman elevated his 31-year-old son Mohammed bin Salman to be crown prince. That means he's next in line to rule, bumping an older, more experienced relative out of the way. Gregory Gauz is a Saudi expert. He teaches international relations at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. Gregory Gauz, who is Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, he is, as you said, the son of the current king, but one of the younger sons of the current king. He's been elevated by his father to a position of unrivaled authority and power in Saudi Arabia. He's minister of defense. He's basically in charge of economic policy. He had been number 2 in line for the throne, but now that his father has removed his cousin, the interior minister, Mohammed bin Nayef, Mohammed bin Salman is next in line.
So how is the crown prince viewed within the kingdom?
I think that there's some amount of support for him. He's young. He's decisive. There are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia that basically said the place needs to be shaken up. We need to take dramatic economic measures. Because oil prices are low, we have to assert ourselves more in the world. He also has some amount of support, I think, on generational issues. You know, he's very young in a place where age has been one of the prerequisites of having a leadership position. On the other hand, there are people who worry that this concentration of power in his hands means that the chances for adventuresome policies, both domestically and in foreign affairs, goes up because there's no check on his power.
Yeah, you mentioned economics. Apparently, the Crown Prince has a big economic plan known as Vision 2030. What is that all about?
Vision 2030 is extremely ambitious. It's an effort to move Saudi Arabia away from its dependence on oil. It's aimed at bolstering the private sector in Saudi Arabia and, most importantly, making the private sector the place that Saudis look for jobs. The vast majority of Saudis work for the government in one way or another. The vast majority of the hires in the private sector are foreign workers. There's probably 8 million foreign workers in Saudi Arabia right now who work for a lower wage in many cases, and employers can have more control over than they can over Saudi nationals. So the issue for now Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is, how do you get the Saudi private sector to hire Saudis? And while those goals are present in Vision 2030, it's not clear what policy steps he's going to take to change the labor market.
What about foreign policy? Do we have any idea how Mohammed bin Salman will work on a foreign policy agenda?
Well, we do have some hints. Mohammed bin Salman was, as defense minister, the face of the Saudi war effort in Yemen. He is also seen as the person behind the current crisis with Qatar, forcing a decision. He was the one who orchestrated President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia. But I think that the interesting thing here is that Saudis probably read President Trump's trip and President Trump's very positive words about Saudi Arabia as an indirect signal that accepting Mohammed bin Salman as crown prince was something Washington would do.
You know, when people talk about the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi, it's not always in admirable terms. They've got oil, the U.S. buys it, we've got weapons, and the Saudis buy them. Does this move signify any shift in kind of the overarching terms of that relationship?
I don't think it signifies a significant shift. The important thing is the style that Mohammed bin Salman brings to Saudi foreign policy. Much less cautious, much more willing to go outside of the limits that America is setting in the Middle East. The Yemen war, the confrontation with Qatar have both, to some extent, alienated American administrations. The Obama administration with Yemen and the Trump administration is not all that happy with the confrontation with Qatar. So I think the issue with Mohammed bin Salman in the United States is going to be more about his style than his substance.
So the Crown Prince is considered by many to be a bold reformer. I guess I want to know just how bold. Like, what are his views on the role of women in Saudi Arabia? Would he support women driving there?
I think that that's the one area where you could see what Americans might think of as reform from Mohammed bin Salman. He has publicly stated on numerous occasions that he thinks women need to play a greater role in society. He stated on numerous occasions that Saudi social life has to open up, both on the entertainment side and in terms of work opportunities for Saudi women and Saudi men. One of the things you need to bring about change in a conservative society is concentration of power. And Mohammed bin Salman has that now.
Gregory Gause teaches international relations at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
So we don't usually do weather updates here on The World, even though the weather is one of those things we can all complain about. It unites us, or maybe brag about. Anyway, we're talking this time an unprecedented heat wave reaching temperatures of, wait for it, 94 degrees. Okay, I know you're hearing about blazing hot 120 degrees plus out in Arizona, so 94 is nothing special for American cities. But in London, it's pretty extreme. Our reporter Leo Hornack is in our London studio, which I gather is fairly acclimatized. But Leo, once you step outside, what's it like?
It's hot, Marco. It's very, very hot. This has been the hottest day since the previous record, which was set way back in the hot summer of 1976. I mean, when you switch on the news, there's reports of things like trains being cancelled due to concerns about the tracks bending. There's warnings about how to deal with the tarmac going sticky. We're not used to seeing these things on the news, and things aren't really designed for it. I mean, in my neighborhood, there's been a kind of run on fans. All the shops have sold out. There's basically a Ben and Jerry's drought at the moment. Any kind of chilled, refreshing drink is going fast, basically.
Yeah, I saw a photograph of a poster in the London Tube today saying, if you smell something weird like shrimp that have been left outside for 6 days, that's probably your neighbor. Anyway, how are people coping given all these extremes?
Well, one forecaster said that people should drink plenty and avoid excessive exercise, which is basically a traditional British summer anyway. So you know.
Except the drinking they're talking about is water, not ale.
Oh, they didn't even specify that. Looking around the BBC newsroom, it's clear that a lot of middle-aged men still kept an old pair of cargo pants from the mid-90s. I don't think I've ever seen quite so many pasty British knees. So, yeah, people are coping. They're making do as they can. But I think we're all going to be quite glad when this weather breaks and we get a little bit of rain.
Okay, Leo, stay cool.
Thanks, Marco.
My friend and colleague at the BBC, Leo Hornack, a heat novice. He'll be fine. In the summer of 1997 in Paris, kind of average heat, but it was also the summer that a young rapper named Passy released Facial. We're dipping into the jukebox for this one, and that's where we'll park it today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, going on vacation for a couple of weeks and leaving you in the capable hands of Carol Hills. Stay cool and keep your dogs out of the hot cars, please. We'll be back with you tomorrow here on The World.
L'été, c'est bon, la température va monter. Là, les beautés, les décolletés, les nouvelles modes sexy, serrées. L'effet d'hiver, les boum boum de quartier zoom. Gros plan de la tête aux pieds, les petits, les grands veulent peser. Les bruits de bécane se précèdent, les marques, les sapes se succèdent. Y'a des coupes nettes sur les mecs en quête d'un bisou, d'une bonne fête. Aux pieds, j'ai mes blanches baskets.
PRI, Public Radio International.